And if you look at the online edition of the Yuba County Code Enforcement Officer's tirade against homeless woman caught on camera story, you find a couple additional specific details, like, he knocked on my door telling me to get out of here, that he was tired of cleaning up after us dirtbags, said resident Hannah Lee. People like me, I clean up after myself, Lee said in the video. Monaco responds, you don't do shit. Lee is then heard telling Monaco he can't speak to her like that. Get out of here before I get the fuck out of here myself, Monaco says. And you also have this specifics. Lee protesting her treatment. You're not a cop. You're not a badge. Nothing, she says in the video. Monaco responds, then what are you? You're a fucking homeless piece of shit. And that was some of the specific language, which you can kind of see, although they don't say fuck and they don't say shit. You see F and S, but it's pretty clear what's said. Also, Jason Steele, the witness who said that he organized a bail effort to get Lee out of jail, even though he didn't know her, on some domestic disputed domestic violence warrant, said he had had a run-in with Monaco, but he said the officer has 17 formal complaints filed against him. And Lee notes that Monaco had a history of bad behavior. Lee told Fox 40 she called Monaco's supervisor after the incident, but no action was taken. County officials said they took action after the videos were seen on social media, even though no formal complaint was filed. So apparently Monaco's superior is not acknowledging there's a difference in the stories of Monaco's superior and Lee's story. But this is a case picked up by the California Homeless Union, Yuba County. We supported it here in Santa Cruz, although we only have the account sent us by Anthony Prince. I tend to believe what he said. And we don't want to see that kind of stuff happening with homeless folks in their vehicles. Even supposed nice guys like Andy Mills, our chief of police. There is a claim in the Good Times story by Lauren Helper that Andy Mills himself has had sort of a, well, there's an incident in his history where he had previously been police chief up in Humboldt County in Eureka. The story reads, Mills faced criticism for uneven enforcement of department rules in his previous role as Eureka police chief. He took issue with the Humboldt Bay firefighter wearing a Black Lives Matter pin on his uniform, though Mills himself was captured in a photo wearing a Police Lives Matter bracelet while on duty. And Mills' response to this was, what happened is that the city's policy is you cannot wear pins of any kind without prior approval from the chief of that department, says Mills, who adds he has also told multiple officers they may not wear pro-Second Amendment pins or other insignias on the job. You have to set a standard or it gets out of control. But what made Police Lives Matter bracelet an exception for Chief Mills himself was that he was showing personal support for officers killed in a 2016 Texas ambush, and the bracelet, he added, was not physically on his uniform. Plus, it was not a violation of the policy. He was also okaying his own right to put it on his wrist, whereas the officer with the Black Lives Matter pin had not gotten the okay from his chief, the fire chief that he was a subordinate to. And that, well, let me think about that for a moment. So technically, Chief Mills was not violating the policy because he okayed his own approval of wearing his bracelet, whereas the fireman did not get his chief's approval wearing Black Lives Matter pin. That's pretty thin stuff, particularly since you're giving yourself approval essentially as an exception to the policy. And also, Police Lives Matter is a clearly political statement. It's not really about Police Lives Matter per se when it's used in a discussion about because it takes It's hard to describe this, but it's a way of demeaning the phrase Black Lives Matter, to say, for example, all lives matter. Because when what you're talking about when you say Black Lives Matter, if you're talking about the particular problems black folks face in terms of the disproportionate number of murders that happen, police murders against black people, whereas police lives matter sounds like a sort of a self-interested way of essentially ignoring that whole issue and saying, no, no, police lives matter too. All lives matter. But it's possible, I suppose, that what Mills meant was he was, in fact, simply trying to show his regard for this cops killed in the 2016 Texas ambush. I mean, I suppose that's a possibility too. It just seems highly nebulous. And on the grim side, we have a couple of other items coming up. In Berkeley, on Tuesday, day after tomorrow, at the Berkeley City Council meeting, there is going to be a RV parking ordinance prohibiting parking during certain hours. And looking at the Berkeley Daily Planet on that issue, what do we find? J.P. Massa writes, "No room at the inn. Attention, Berkeley residents, do you have one of the signs that says, no matter where you're from, we're glad you're our neighbor. We believe no human is illegal. I'm sorry, but your sign is no longer operative. You're going to have to change it to, no matter where you're from, we're glad you're our neighbor. We believe no human is illegal, asterisk, unless you are a resident of Berkeley living in your car, a camper van, or an RV. Because on Thursday, February 28th at the Berkeley City Council, they voted 6-3 to pass the first reading of one of the most inhumane ordinances it has ever taken up. It voted to condemn those residents of Berkeley who are homeless but in possession of an RV or car for their shelter and transportation needs to either banishment or sleeping in doorways. They did this by banning RVs from parking on city streets in the wee hours of the morning from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. This is the Cynthia Matthews law. In Santa Cruz, we call it permit parking, but Berkeley did it citywide. They couldn't do it in Santa Cruz because Santa Cruz is a coastal town that has to go through the Coastal Commission, which in essence turned away their ordinance or said you have to justify it with more details rather than just inflammatory rhetoric and false generalizations or vague generalizations such as Scott Collins and Rochelle Naroyan provided several years ago when they passed that ordinance in Santa Cruz. Berkeley is less fortunate, however. They passed a citywide ordinance apparently in February that said no parking on city streets from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. That is, of course, unless you can get a permit, I believe. Let's see what, I think there's more details to this. When faced with a homeless crisis, after professing to want to do everything possible to alleviate said crisis, and after declaring recurring shelter emergencies, sounds a bit like Santa Cruz, the city council voted to make homelessness an even more extreme problem in Berkeley than it is already. The action was driven by complaints from housed residents and business owners in West Berkeley. Sound familiar? This is exactly the mob of people who came to city council in the last two or three council meetings to dismiss very modest changes in ordinances, such as removing the already illegal signs on Delaware Street about parking at night. That was dumped, or they scared away the council from voting or discussing that after Justin Cummings stated that he was going to respond to the needs of these privileged neighbors whose apparent objective is to clear away the very prospect of seeing poor people on the streets at night because they're such a menace. And then again, of course, more recently, the attempt to eliminate the notion of a shelter emergency that would involve some kind of real opportunity to set up 24-hour encampments in different places in the city, as well as a variety of other measures provided by, at one time, by Drew Glover, but he has since sort of pulled in his horns on these matters. And even Christopher Crone, who initially presented a proposal that city council members were elected on to some extent, which was to stop the attempt to dump the current library and shovel it under a 5-story parking structure. He wanted to revisit that, but Sandy Brown sabotaged that effort by saying she needed more information before she would even allow it to be put on the agenda, or gave that impression to Crone, who then meekly withdrew his proposal, simply that the matter be put on the next city council agenda for further discussion. I think it was 2 agendas away. That wasn't good enough for Brown, and of course, she was perhaps listening to the ranting and yapping of Watkins, Matthews, and Myers. Anyway, back in Berkeley, instead of considering reasonable regulations to limit the number or density of RVs in any one location to provide assistance to those surviving in RVs by providing dumping facilities, and or treating those forced to live in RVs, including children, as human beings, as almost the entire public requested before the vote, even those insisting that something be done, the council chose a draconian response. This is in Berkeley, but in Santa Cruz it's quite similar. No public speaker, including those most affected by the aggregation of RVs in West Oakland, spoke in favor of outright banishment, and yet the council could hardly contain itself in its eagerness to enact legislation that no one in the community apparently advocated nor apparently wanted. Not only is this vote by the Berkeley City Council cruel, but the ordinance or parts of it and existing law that prohibits living in vehicles may be against the law, because in June of 2014, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a ban on living in vehicles as unconstitutionally vague and an invitation to discriminate against the poor. That was the Desert Rain decision. And in August 2018, in Bloom versus San Diego, a federal judge blocked San Diego from enforcing municipal code outlawing living in vehicles because, quote, the ordinance is both vague on its face and is being arbitrarily enforced. And then, of course, in September of last year, in Martin versus Boise, the Ninth Circuit ruled it was unconstitutional to outlaw people's needs as human beings in public spaces, such as the necessity for sleep, if a city could not provide a place for them to go. The city of Berkeley has continued to refuse to designate any place for Berkeley resident RV dwellers to live, not to mention those who aren't in RVs. The city has evicted them from their previous residences at the marina, and its shelters are full. Outlawing their residences, their RVs, and condemning them to effective banishment or unsheltered street survival arguably falls under a similar rubric. Regardless of the legal and constitutional, Berkeley is engaging in the unethical and immoral, and so, of course, is Santa Cruz. We profess our support and willingness to provide sanctuary for those from foreign lands, yet we refuse to humanely deal with those of us within our city's borders on the brink of losing all they have. It's time for the council and each of us to look a little more carefully into the mirror to reconsider what we are doing, and on March 26th, for the council to refuse to enact this ordinance into law, because it's coming up for a second reading in Berkeley day after tomorrow. And that's the story by J.P. Massar in the online Berkeley Daily Planet, No Room at the Inn. And here's a story, Homeless People in Cages. A Poverty Scholar national tour finds people locked up in St. Petersburg, Florida. This is by Tiny, who writes for, I think she writes for Poor magazine up in the north, and she also writes for a 48 Hills newsletter. And I'm going to read some of that. Here lies the unhoused soldier killed in the undeclared war on the poor, just trying to survive outside, to hide under on a bus bench, away from your eyes, park bench, or out of the rain in a door. It's an excerpt from Here Lies the Unhoused Soldier. One lone piece of crumpled paper seems to float on the ray of streetlight shining in the empty Florida night air. I followed it, unable to face what my eyes had just seen. Maybe if I could just focus on that tiny piece of paper, the 14-foot-tall chain-link enclosure sitting on the sidewalk filled with humans would stop being real. The paper landed next to a row of landfill and trash cans that seemed to stretch around the block. The bins stood in the tiny space between the curb and the sidewalk where the cage-like enclosure began. Have you heard of cages for immigrant children? Well, they have them here for homeless people, said Pastor G.W., a formerly houseless poverty scholar and pastor from Mission Dai Congregation in occupied Seminole territory, which we call St. Petersburg. We used to have tent cities right down the street here in St. Petersburg. Me and G.W. were the street sheriffs making sure people were safe at night, said Bruce Wright, formerly houseless poverty scholar with the Poor People's Economic Rights Campaign and pastor of the Refuge Ministries of Tampa Bay, pointing at the long, empty, dark street next to the people's cages. While Bruce and G.W. were narrating this sci-fi horror movie in front of our eyes, myself, D. Allen, and Auntie Frances from Homefulness Poor magazine, who are blessed to be in St. Petersburg doing a Theater of the Poor poetry and theater workshop with houseless parishioners from Mission Dai as part of the tour for the just-released Poverty Scholarship textbook, were handing out pizzas to unhoused folks standing at the perimeter of the cages. This is one of the worst U.S. cities to unhoused people, and that's why Mission Dai is facing eviction here and why they're building this huge police station right across the street from us here. This whole city is full of anti-poor people, hate, and police harassment of houseless people, concluded Bruce. As Bruce spoke, my eyes fixed on a huge armored truck with big block letters on it, SWAT, permanently parked across the street from the people's cages to make sure none of us dangerous poor people escaped, I guess. In February of 2019, us Poe and homeless folks at Poor Magazine released Poverty Scholarship, Poor People Led Theory, Art, Works, and Tears Across Mama Earth, a poor, houseless, and disabled people's textbook of lived knowledge from impacted people, filled with actionable solutions, deep critiques, and liberation medicine in what I affectionately call philanthropimping, budget violence, poverty, homelessness, criminalization, service provision, education, art and healing, urgently needed solutions like the Bank of Community Reparations, and radical redistribution, the template of homefulness, and so much more. Seeing as we poor and houseless folk at Poor Magazine are very clear that we are collectively in what I call states of emergency, we set up a holistic sliding scale book tour, which is a solution in and of itself. Academia supports the travel of our unhoused and poor bodies to different cities in occupied Turtle Island, so we can share the people's school medicine of community reparations, interdependence, radical redistribution, decolonization, and degentrification with privileged folks in universities, and then we do Poverty Scholars Theater of the Poor Theater and Poetry Workshops with fellow Poverty Scholars, that's, I guess, scholars, but another way of putting it, nearby, taking the medicine of writing, poetry, poor people-led media, and solutions like homefulness. Sadly, the tour is only 1/8 done. So far, we've gone to L.A. and Florida, and we Poverty Scholars are already deep in triggered pain. The L.A. tour was amazing, and we shared love at the Skid Row Museum with the beautiful Poverty Scholars from the L.A. Poverty Department, Radio Justice Comrades, and Tia Chuckas, which was all magical, beautiful folk like us up here in the Bay who are all struggling with the war on the poor. I can't even speak, Auntie Frances, who, like me and Dee, Leroy Moore, and Tiburcio, were all on the tour leading the workshops, have all dealt with endless criminalization of our unhoused, disabled, and criminalized bodies, lives, belongings, and spaces. And like Driver Plaza in Oakland, where Auntie Frances deals with an endless amount of police harassment, or police harassment, as she puts it, which when she operates her beautiful black-led self-help hunger program, was still completely destroyed by this scene. This is too much, and what they want to do with all of us, she concluded. This frightening witnessing in St. Petersburg began, somewhat appropriately, with our academia trip to Florida State University, which in typical settler colonizer style uses abuses and fetishizes First Nations Seminole culture as part of their mascot system for all their sports teams, including an appropriated spear and face-painted white boys on horses wearing sacred war bonnets at the start of every game. After the presentation, it was on to St. Petersburg, where there is not only legislation in place to incarcerate, arrest, and test every poor person they can get, just like they have in San Francisco, Oakland, L.A., Berkeley, New York, and pretty much every city across the country, but they have just rolled out the logical progression. A nonprofit group calling themselves CARE, C-A-R-E, in St. Petersburg's has literally set up cages on the sidewalk outside their center. The cages are locked at night, literally locking all of the houseless folk in. In the morning, they unlock the cages and literally throw us out onto the street. Of course, all of us homeless folks who have lived with the shelter system in the U.S. know that most of all shelters are low-level jails. So in addition to indigenous brown babies from the other side of the colonial borders in the U.S., we now officially have cages for houseless people in Florida. This, of course, is in St. Petersburg, which has made it illegal to lean on a building while houseless. In Santa Cruz, of course, it's just illegal to sit next to a building. And that is still the law in downtown Santa Cruz. But lest you think this is a dystopian sci-fic movie scene only happening in St. Petersburg, think again. Berkeley, California has a new law added to the already over 100 laws to make it illegal for houseless folk to put a backpack on the ground. And San Francisco, as we already know from Poor Magazine, is confirmed by the police last week in a sweeps hearing called by Supervisor Matt Haney and the Coalition on Homelessness. The SFPD has continued violent sweeps even in the rain and freezing weather. And we've heard something similar happening here in Santa Cruz recently as the last week or two. In previous stories by this Poverty Scola and PNNKEXU reports and stories we have reported on the intentional end of poor people housing by Paul Trickster Moves, so I won't repeat myself, and rather I ask you all who are reading this story who might be housed to listen to the hard work of We Search and the Medicine of Poverty Scholarship. And the story goes on and continues for a bit. And I'll let you check it out online. If you want to find it, go to Homeless People in Cages, and you'll be able to read the rest of it. It's, I've read you most of it, but it's quite a read.
Night woman, his daddy was adrift, the drummer. One night they put it together. 9 months later came the little black bummer. He was a laid back lump in the cradle. During the paint chips that fell from the ceiling, Whenever he cried, he got a fist in his face. So he learned not to show his feelings. He was a pigtail puller in grammar school, and back twice by the seventh grade, sniffing glue in junior high, and the first one in school to get laid. A weed speed pusher at 15, he was mainlining skag a year later, and he started pimping when they put him away. King Jelly changed from a junkie to a hater, and just like a man from the precinct said, on the street he robbed an A&P. He didn't blink at the body that he shot at, and just about the time they would have caught him too, he had the damn good fortune to get drafted. He was A1 bait for Vietnam. You see, they needed more bodies in a hurry. He was a cinch to train, cause all they had to do was the figure had a funnel is fury. Ah, they put him in a tank near the DMZ to catch the cooks slipping over the border. And they said his mission was to search and destroy, and for once he followed another. Soaked day in the Yung Po Valley, with the ground still steaming from the rain, there was a bloody little battle that didn't mean nothing, except to the few that remained. You see, a couple hundred slants had trapped the other five tanks, and it started to pick off the crews. When it came on the scene, and it really did seem, this is why he'd paid those dues. It was something like a butcher gone berserk, or a sane man acting like a fool, or the bravest thing that a man had ever done, or the madman blowing his cool. Well, it came on through like a knife through butter, or a scythe sweeping through the grass, or to say it like a man would have said it himself, just a big black bastard kicking ass. Just like a man from a precinct said, put him away, you better kill him instead. A bummer like that, he's better off dead. Someday they're gonna have to put a bullet in his and the smoke had cleared. There were a lot of VC bodies in the mud. And when the rescued men came over for the very first time, they found him smiling as he lay in his blood. They picked up the pieces and they stitched him back together. He pulled through, though they thought he was a goner, and it forced them to give him what they said they would. 6 Purple Hearts and the Medal of Honor. Of course he slouched as the cheap white honky said, service beyond the call of duty. But the first soft thought was passing through his mind, I'm a medal as a mother of a beauty. Couple of jobs with a ribbon on his chest, and though he tried, he really couldn't do them. There were only a couple of things he'd
that he was really trained for, and he found himself drifting back to us. Just about the time he was ready to break, the VA stopped sending him his checks. Just a matter of time, 'cause there weren't no doubt about what he was gonna do next. It ended up one night in a grocery store, gun in hand and 9 cops at the door. And when his last battle was over, he lay crumpled and broken on the floor. And just like the man from the precinct said, pull him away, you better kill him instead. A bummer like that is better off dead. Someday they're gonna have to put a bullet in his head. Well, he breathed his last, but 10 minutes passed before they dared to enter the place. And when they flipped his riddled body over, they found his second smile frozen on his face. They found his gun where he'd thrown it. There was something else clenched in his fist. And when they pried his fingers open, they found the Medal of Honor. And the sergeant said, when the hell he get this? There was a stew about burying him in Arlington, so they shipped him in a box to Fayette. And they stashed him in a grave in the county flat, the kind we remember to forget. And just like the man from the precinct said, burn him away, you better kill him instead. A bummer like that is better off dead. Someday they're gonna have to put a bullet in his head.
And that was Harry Chapin's Bummer. I think that's the name of it. Bummer. You're tuned to Free Radio still, or the stream of Free Radio anyway, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and we're going to continue with a bit more of Bathrobespierre's Broadsides. And now it's back to the Red Church from some interviews from the 11th of March.
Thank you, Ellie.
Steve Plaich, hi Steve, you're in the middle of doing some hard work back here in the kitchen, but you have some information for the next week?
Yeah, well, as everybody knows, the City Council tomorrow night at 7 o'clock session, they're going to be voting on an ordinance for transitional encampments and safe parking. So what I've done, since I really have sent ahead my plans for safe parking, I sent them a long email today urging the adoption of that ordinance, and urge them to create safe spaces parking programs immediately on kind of the outline that I included in the email.
Is it an urgency ordinance?
Well, the part of it is an urgency ordinance. I'm not certain what part is. I think safe...
So it doesn't go to the Planning Commission.
Safe parking is part of this urgency ordinance. But I also sent a cover copy of everything to our good friend Alicia Cole, as you know, who is my designated program manager for that program. So I'm hoping that Alicia will speak to that at council tomorrow as a member of the Vehicle House community, because I think that carries a lot more weight than myself, even though I conceived of the program and drafted the program. She knows a lot more about that community and about the importance of creating safe spaces parking programs.
Who will make the choice, the manager or the actual city council? Once, if this is adopted, either as an urgency or through the Planning Commission, who will choose who actually runs the program?
Well, I suspect that it will be city staff. city staff may, unfortunately, may making recommendations to council, but perhaps this council, with a little stronger leadership, can persuade staff that there are people identified in the community who are qualified to run these programs and who should be given priority in terms of creating these programs immediately, because the Santa Cruz Homeless Depot, which Phil Poser and I began, which is an active California corporation, and we do have a fiscal sponsor, United Nations Association.
Now, you were turned down for funding on that. What's your sense of why that happened?
Well, the reason was that they said that I didn't have a secure or identified site. I was very disappointed that the council didn't act on RV safe spaces parking earlier and identify sites, because that would have remedied that problem. But unfortunately, they are a little late in acting.
Martine Watkins kept it off the agenda, right?
Well, however it happened, I think that the HEAP funders and HAP may have been more inclined to grant funding for that had they seen that there were identified sites and there were safe sites and those sites were within the city limits and had been identified by the city of Santa Cruz. Unfortunately, now we're working in hindsight. I did not get the funding, and we're just going to have to go from where we are. But I have hopes that we'll be able to get programs going.
What kind of funding were you seeking?
The HEAP funding was $91,000 for 27 months. And that simply included the physically be able to setting sites up, the payment of personnel, program, an operations manager, which would be Alicia, one assistant for her. So those things are essential, that you have people on site who are familiar with, the RV community, and not simply have people there for security who know nothing about the community and really care nothing about the community. So we're hopeful that they'll see the light, and we will see.
So we'll know about this, sometime next year? Or?
Okay. They'll have to determine their timeline tomorrow night. They seem to have some sense of urgency themselves. So if there is any kind of urgency element to the ordinance, we should be able to get this started, soon. As soon as they give us the green light, then we can start going.
Well, I know that in the past you've been somewhat skeptical of Drew Glover's in terms of various past campaigns. Has your opinion of him altered at all?
Well, it's difficult to say. I think that his intentions are good. I think his heart's in the right place. I'm not certain that his grasp of city governance has the kind of clarity that I would like to see, but I think he'll grow into the job. It's just an organic process for him, and so he's trying to negotiate bureaucracies with which he's not familiar. It takes a lot to be able to govern. It takes a knowledge of how the city is funded, how appropriations are made, how consensus is made. None of that has been handled, in my view, as well as it could have been. And so I think that we're a little behind the curve in terms of all the progressive programs we had hoped would be at least agendized and being seriously considered and maybe moving toward approval on a much more expedited basis than we have now.
What's missing from this agenda item, which you probably have seen, that's on for tomorrow night?
Probably supportive services. I think that they're thinking about, let's just move people somewhere. And maybe I don't see as much thought given to the kind of supportive services that people need in order to really succeed in those environments and really transition from being unsheltered to something more integrated into our community, presuming that's what they want. But I do think they should offer those things.
What do you mean by supportive services?
Navigating into housing, navigating into employment, navigating back into benefits, having somebody really be able to tell you that you either are or are not eligible for some benefits, or you either are or are not eligible for housing, and really navigate
the non-existent housing, the non-existent jobs, and the very shrinking benefit.
It's all, much of it is in hypothetical, but we deal with what we have.
And we've been talking with...
Hey, Richard.
It is about inclusivity. We want to be an inclusive society. We do not want to exclude. We don't want to mob. We don't want to harass. We don't want to intimidate. We don't want to provoke. We want to have an inclusive society. We don't want to marginalize. We don't want to oppress. Okay, thank you.
And we've been talking with
Julie Shaw, Santa Cruz Full-Timers, and some of those words I have to give credit to Graham Press from Seattle State University. He's an anthropologist, Graham Press, P-R-U-S-S, look them up.
Thank you.
So looking at Steve Plaich's prediction of what would happen the next night, which was last Tuesday at City Council, the actual resolution that did pass was a revised shelter crisis declaration, amending that no shelter will be placed in parks, beaches, streets, and sidewalks without first requiring public review and permitting a process with conditions of approval to be handled, however, directly by the City Council level rather than by the Planning Commission level, which sounds like it was a change, although that wasn't passed, I don't think, may have been passed as an urgency ordinance, but it wasn't specified as an urgency ordinance. That means that it would be passed with a supermajority of the council of 5 votes at least, and would be done as a sort of a first and final reading instead of a first reading and a second reading, as is traditionally the case with, certainly with laws. The item also passed on the agenda on March 19th was it only allows public exemptions for fully managed, professionally staffed, with the inclusion of volunteer participation in secure shelter facilities. That was Cynthia Matthews' amendment. I'm not sure if it really means much, except she really was desirous of closely controlling, I think, any kind of shelters that were placed. Where we're talking about shelters in parking lots, where they would be sleeping outside in tents, but in not necessarily in 24-hour encampments, which I think she didn't really want to get into at all, and which the council did not vote for at that time. Also, they requested the County of Santa Cruz, not just the city, but the county, expressly requested to create and locate shelter outside the city, bear its fair share. Declaration will remain in effect for 1 year. And then they also directed the city manager to implement a small-scale safe sleeping and storage program for 50 people and direct the staff to pursue Lot 24, which is the lot I think I mentioned before near the depot area out by Washington Street, for 30 days with the option to renew by the council in 30-day increments with community input and a problem-solving process to address the issue of proximity to the businesses, and direct staff to bring the council back to council for approval. And I'm not really sure if Plaich got what he wanted. Alicia Kuhl has presented on Santa Cruz Indie Media her proposal for a sleep space at the Depot Park. Actually, she opposes the sleep space at the Depot Park at Lot 24 and supports an encampment at Harvey West. And she writes, opening up a safe sleep space located in Lot 24 near Depot Park in Santa Cruz is causing an outrage from neighbors and concerned citizens. A safe sleep spot does not meet shelter criteria, is not good for anyone. Your concerns about this are totally logical. It'll force people to find a place to exist during the daytime hours in that area. Instead, she proposes, as well as the Ross Camp Council, she says, proposes a better idea, working with the city for a few months to see a pilot encampment. Unfortunately, the whole issue of encampment was really put off, it sounded like to me, for many months, even though it was proposed several months ago by Drew Glover. His interns got together and worked out a proposal which Martine Watkins refused, the mayor, refused to put on the agenda, and which, even though Glover asked that it be agendized in the actual council itself so that Watkins couldn't do this ignoring the issue and not putting it on the agenda because it got voted on the agenda by 4 votes. Once it came up on the agenda, it got kind of shoveled into a late-night session. And I really don't have a really clear notion of what happened to it, but perhaps when Glover gets back from his trip, which I guess he's beginning tomorrow, and he won't be at the Tuesday City Council meeting the day after tomorrow, we'll learn more about that. And here's a pretty grim story, but actually quite believable, considering the state of things in this country these days.
Thank you, Jeff. Now to an update on the 2016 firing of San Antonio Bike Patrol officer Matthew Luckhurst. Luckhurst was suspended indefinitely back in October 2016 on accusations he gave a homeless man a sandwich filled with feces. That decision, however, was overturned by an arbitrator this week. The new ruling, based on a state policy that prevents law enforcement from disciplining an officer for conduct happening more than 180 days prior to being disciplined. In Luckhurst's case, the alleged incident was initially said to have occurred back on May 6, 2016. However, Luckhurst later provided medical records explaining the incident happened weeks before, putting the disciplinary time frame outside the 180-day window. Right now on our website, we go into further detail, including Luckhurst's recap of what exactly happened that day and what the arbitrator reveals about the initial investigation. That's available right now on KSAT.com.